This is an interview with Lieutenant Randall H. Cunningham, United States Navy, fighter pilot in the Vietnam War, and first all-missile ace. Lieutenant Cunningham was born in Los Angeles, California on 8 December 1941. Shortly thereafter, his family moved to Missouri, where he graduated from high school. He attended the University of Missouri, where he took a master's degree in education administration and a master's degree in physical education. Prior to entering the United States Navy, he was football and swimming coach at Hinsdale High School, Missouri, and then head swimming coach at the University of Missouri. He joined the United States Navy in 1966, was commissioned an ensign in January 1967, and earned his pilot's wings on 24 September 1968. He made two combat cruises to Vietnam with Fighter Squadron 96, one on board USS America and one in USS Constellation. He flew 276 combat missions in Vietnam. On 19 January 1972, Lieutenant Cunningham engaged two MiG-21s and shot down one. On 8 May 1972, he engaged three MiG-17s and shot one from his wingman's tail. On 10 May 1972, Lieutenant Cunningham's flight was jumped by 21 MiG-17s, 19s, and 21s. He shot down three of the 22, which gave him a total of five, making him the first ace of the Vietnam conflict. During this engagement, he shot down a MiG-17 from his XO's tail while being directly attacked by four MiG-17s, four MiG-19s, and two MiG-21s. For this action, he was nominated for the Medal of Honor. Lieutenant Cunningham was the first all-missile ace, the first to shoot down three MiGs in one engagement, and the first F-4 Phantom ace. His last kill was North Vietnam's leading ace, Colonel Thun, with 13 American kills to his credit. Lieutenant Cunningham saw MiGs three times and downed MiGs three times while never losing a wingman. Lieutenant Cunningham was one of the most highly decorated Navy pilots of the war. After shooting down his third MiG of the engagement, Lieutenant Cunningham turned to fight a fourth attacking aircraft but was forced to disengage by eight other MiGs. He turned toward the Gulf of Tonkin but was hit by a surface-to-air missile deep in enemy territory. Rather than eject and become a prisoner of war, he flew the burning F-4 out over the Gulf, where he and his radar intercept officer ejected and were rescued by friendly forces. This interview is being conducted at the Naval Air Station Miramar, San Diego, California, on 22 March 1974. The interviewer is Captain R.A. Bowling, United States Navy retired, a graduate student at the San Diego State University. Lieutenant Cunningham, if you'd start off, please, basically with your background biographic data.
I was born in Los Angeles, California. I shortly moved to Missouri with my parents, where I went through high school. I went to the University of Missouri, where I got a master's in educational administration and a master's degree in physical education. I coached football and swimming at Hinsdale High School, where we put three swimmers in the Olympics. We were undefeated the entire time I was there. I was later coached at the University of Missouri, was a head swimming coach, and there decided that I wanted to fly. An Air Force captain, an Air Force lieutenant colonel, asked me if I wanted to start flying. I told him yes, and then he advised that I join the military. Well, I joined the Navy instead of the Air Force, and in 1966, I was sworn in at Glenview, Illinois. In January of 67, I was commissioned as an ensign, and 24 September 1968, I earned my wings of gold at in Beeville, Texas. On 8 April 1970, I left Norfolk, Virginia on my first cruise aboard the USS America, CVA 66, in the Southeast Asia conflict.
Okay, now, you received your wings of gold. Now, I understand there are two types of aviators, the naval flight officer and the pilot. Which were you?
I was the pilot type in this conflict. The brief time that we spent in Southeast Asia was about a year, and it wasn't too eventful. You cut it off there. I said, we were in Southeast Asia about a year. Our cruise was pretty uneventful. However, we did expend more ordnance than any other carrier had since the beginning of the war in Vietnam. We weren't bombing North Vietnam at the time. It was in 1968 that President Johnson had called a cessation of the bombing of the North, and our main strikes were down in Laos, mainly road interdiction, trying to stop the trucks coming down through the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
What type of aircraft were you flying at that time?
I was flying the F-4J Phantom.
Is that a two-seater? Or
it's a two-seater.
Who was flying backseat with you?
I had a different RIO at this time than I did on my second cruise. Lynn Batterman was my main RIO, the guy I flew with most, and he left after this cruise. As I said, the trucks were coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail in 1969. We weren't allowed to strike into the north. The only thing, only strikes in the north were protective reaction type strikes or possible overflights by the photo RA-5s, taking picture of military installations and finding out what the North Vietnamese were doing at the time. We spent a year over there and came back. And then a little bit later on in the year, I think it was October of 71, is when you might have read in the newspapers that the USS Constellation sailed out of port under protest. They had some sailors that was seeking sanctuary in a church. Those sailors did come out and they sailed with the Constellation, but it was under protest at the time. We had an escort. I remember at that time the feeling of trying to support a country that had people in it like that. And I'm sure that that view was expressed, although we knew that it was a minority, it still bothered a lot of us. The word was that the North was becoming very active.
Just back to that, when you say it disturbed a lot of you, in a negative sense or a positive? In other words, were you in sympathy with their feelings, or were you not in sympathy with their feelings?
No, I believe that a person has a right to protest. But if a person wants to protest, as far as that he refuses to go to war, then he should have made that commitment prior to the time of having to go. As far as draft evaders and the rest of it, no, I don't agree with those people. I do agree that a person has a right to dissent and make his feelings known, but not to those degrees. We were on our way across, and we'd heard from other carriers. We have friends. The Navy's a small unit, especially the fighter community, and I had letters from some of the guys already over there flying that the pressure over there was becoming pretty high, that the North had moved surface air missiles down in the DMZ and as far as down in Laos. They had heavy AAA in Laos, where our first cruise, very few of us actually ever saw surface air missiles or heavy AAA concentrations. We did get shot at, but it wasn't that heavy. We got over there sometime in December, and my first strike into Laos was an eye-opener. I remember the first time I ever dropped a bomb in Laos. It was a road cut. We rolled in. You expect to get shot at, like John Wayne did in the movie and the rest of it. And it's a real quiet thing. You're bombing a nice country road, putting a hole in it so trucks can't come down. You don't see any shooting. You go back and land aboard your carrier, and it's pretty much like you practice out here with nobody shooting at you. But each mission we would fly the next 9 months, there was maybe one or two where we didn't get shot at. And by getting shot at, I mean the whole sky was filled with AAA. And this is all the way from 23 millimeter all the way up to 120 millimeter at times. And thrown in for good luck were a few SAMs, even in Laos. We
What type of aircraft are you flying at this time? Still the F-4?
Still the F-4. In combat, I flew the F-4, and Willie Driscoll was assigned to the squadron. And Willie, I had a choice. I had just lost the RAO, and being an experienced combat pilot, I had the choice of RAOs that I wanted coming into the squadron. Well, I lined up three rows and looked at their backgrounds and how they did in the flight training, and they told me that one of them had a keg of beer in his back of his car, and I said, well, who is that? And he said, that's Willie Driscoll, and that's, I chose Willie to become my RAO. He's a pretty good gent and still a good friend. We continued the strikes in the north, or in the south, excuse me, and then just at the end of December, in the start of January of 72, President Nixon came out that we would bomb the north. And we had our first strikes, and that the name of that was called Proud Deep. It's where Washington gave us a brief time, a total of, I think, 5 days, I'm not sure the number of days, to stop the supplies in the north through heavy raids leading down to the north. And up to this time, we would bomb the passes. There was Magia Pass, Bankarai, and Napi. And we'd bomb these passes or on the Laotian side when we couldn't go into the north. And all the supplies that came in from China, Russia, and the rest of it would come into port. They'd go through a mountain chain through these passes and then filter down to the Ho Chi Minh Trail into the embattled troops in the south. Well, we could bomb these supplies once they got into Laos, but we couldn't go on the other side of the passes. And on the other side of these passes, they had trucks backed up for, 50 miles that we couldn't lay our hands on. Well, they said, okay, we'll give you so many days to knock out these trucks and to retard the supply going down to the troops. Because at this time, the North had, I don't know how many thousands of regulars in the South, which they would not admit to, and they were expecting a major invasion of the North, which did come a few months later. Well, the thing was that the weather was bad. It was overcast, and we'd learned not even to bomb over an overcast in Laos in a fairly non-hostile environment, which I mean by that there's not that much AAA, there's not very many SAMs and so on. The reason being that when you're making a bombing run, if a SAM is launched, you almost have to see it come off the pad. If you don't see it, it's going to hit you. And an overcast, you don't see that missile launching off the pad, and by the time you see it, it's going Mach 2 or Mach 3, and it's very hard to get away from them.
What's a Mach, Lieutenant?
Mach 1 is the speed of sound.
Yeah, and miles per hour.
Well, it depends on the altitude, really. At sea level or...
At deck level, roughly.
I don't really know.
About 670, I think.
But it's something like that. It depends on a standard day and the temperature right. And the pressure and the rest of it. So the missile's doing almost 1,800 miles an hour, maybe 2,000 miles an hour. Well, these supplies that we were supposed to bomb, there was an overcast. And another reason, you can't see the roads when there's an overcast, a cloud overcast. So the admirals, the people in charge out there, called back to Washington on their hotline, I guess out of Saigon, I don't know the means they do, and they said, we can't do this in this many days because of the weather. Well, Washington came back and said, you have these days to do it. If you don't do it then, you're not going to do it. So they said, well, we'll bite the bullet, and we'll use our A-6s that have a radar that scan under the clouds and supposedly can paint a target through the clouds, and then they can drop bombs on it. Well, the F-4s lined up on these A-6s and the other attack airplanes and flew wing, and we were flying straight and level over a hostile environment with heavy AAA. This is Vinh, this is North Vietnam, not Laos. And we lost, I don't know how many airplanes. A lot of our guys were killed. The Air Force lost almost an equal, I think slightly more, amount of airplanes. This is a mistake. And some decisions like this are reasons why a lot of our guys got killed over there. And it's one that myself and a lot of other people are very bitter about. And even the mention of Proud Deep, the results of those strikes were very poor. We missed a lot of the targets. The A-6's gear didn't work that good in that situation. And a lot of our friends were either killed or taken POW.
And this time frame again, Lieutenant.
This was the latter part of December, the 1st of January of 1972.
72, 73?
72, 1972.
Well, you said December and January.
December of 71.
Okay.
And January of 72.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we went on like that, and there were several periods where it would come up and say, okay, we're going to hold. We're not going to bomb the North again. So we'd go back to our strikes in Laos. And the different carriers, some would be staged down around Saigon. The North Vietnamese were launching an invasion against An Loc and also against Hue at that time, and Quang Tri City. And this was all in all the papers back there. So we would try and support the South Vietnamese regulars around Quang Tri City. There was also a carrier working around An Loc, the people coming out of Cambodia. Well, it finally came about, and I don't remember the exact date, that where we definitely started going back into the North. Well, at this time, every target had to be targeted. And you heard the story of bombing of the dikes by Jane Fonda and Ramsey Clark and the rest of them. Well, they claim that we bombed dikes on purpose. I was over there and I flew almost 300 combat missions into the North. And not one time did we ever bomb a dike that was targeted. But I'll tell you this, a lot of my friends were lost and I saw a lot of airplanes shot down. Some of those airplanes were shot down by guns that were mounted on those dikes. And when in a slow attack airplane rolls in on a military type target, now this is supplies, this is a gun placement or a SAM site, something like this, not a civilian settlement, but when they roll in on a military target and these guns start shooting from a dike, which isn't a military advantage for them. It's high, it's elevated, the gun has full sweep. It's an advantage for them to put it up there on the dike. We know this. They know it. Those guns have got to be stopped or the guys rolling in are going to die. So we do bomb those guns. Now, if they're mounted on a dike, there's going to be a big hole in that dike. And a lot of these holes were the ones that Jane Fonda and the rest of them referred to. So as far as targeting dikes, that's a bunch of nonsense. It never happened. We continued going through the North, and it was in January, it started out where the newspapers back here in town started talking about B-52 raids into Laos and in the North. The Air Force started their B-52 raids working up in northern Laos, and at this time the North Vietnamese decided to launch MiG-21s and MiG-17s out against the B-52s. And on several occasions, the B-52s running up the Laotian border would be attacked by MiG-21s. Well, these MiG-21s were launching out of Quang Lang Airfield, which is very close to the border, and they were also coming out of Bai Thong MiG base. We had a photo bird fly over Quang Lang Airfield on a reconnaissance mission, and they saw MiG-21s being pushed back into karst caves. And at that point, they had AAA emplacements around the field, they had SAM emplacements, they had troops moving down the trails. So at a later time, they decided to take another photo bird, this was about a few days later, and see what movement and what activity was going on around Quang Lang Airfield. Well, another lead up, prior to this time, when we could not go into the North, the passes we would bomb. And say a gun would shoot at us from the north side as we were in Laos. Well, we couldn't shoot that gun for a while, or we couldn't bomb it. Or, and then someone wised up and says, hey, we're losing people. If they're shooting at us, we ought to be able to knock out that gun emplacement, which is right. So we would bomb that emplacement. You could not have a gun shoot at you, go back and tell people about it, and then launch a strike against that gun. You had to attack it while it was in process of shooting at your flight.
Is this what was known as protective reaction?
This is called protective reaction strike. Okay, so therefore, we were forced a lot of times when the photo birds would go over the north to have an attack group setting out to the side, waiting. Now, if that photo bird was shot at, then we would send in the strike and stop that gun sight or that missile sight from firing. Well, this is what happened on 19 January, 1972. This is a day that Bill Driscoll and myself were flying MIGCAP. And MIGCAP in an F-4 is the attack airplanes are slow, they carry bombs and they drop bombs. The F-4 is basically a fighter type plane. We fight air to air. Well, we protect the attack airplanes as they're over the target from MIGs, the MIG type airplane. The basic MIGs were the MiG-17, the MiG-19, and the MiG-21 in Southeast Asia that we were forced to go against. Well, on 19 January, we sent a photo bird over Quang Lang for the second time. And at that time, all hell let loose, and they started firing SAMs, AAA. They launched 18 SAMs in pairs. Brian Grant, my wingman, and Jerry Sullivan, his radar intercept officer, some people call him RIO for radar intercept officer, some people call him GIB for guy in the back. Brian was my wingman. We flew directly over the field in an attempt to pick up any MiGs launching out of that field.
Which field?
Of Quang Lang. And to place ourselves between Bai Thong Airfield, which was a little farther north. It bared about 030 at 65 miles from Quang Lang. And we're going to place ourselves between the two fields, and if anything launched out of Quang Lang, Bai Thong, or Than Wah, which is another MiG field, and also where the Than Wah bridges are, like in, I guess, Korea, the famous war, that the bridges of Toko Ri, well, that was our bridge of Toko Ri, Than Wah Bridge. But it didn't work out that well. We had 18 SAM shot at us in pairs, and we were breaking all over the sky just trying to save our own rears from the ground fire. Brian and I got separated at that point, and he was evading one SAM and I was evading another SAM. We broke down into it. I was going through about 15,000 feet, nose low, just trying to get some energy back up and trying to get out of the area. The SAM missiles got a range of about 17 miles, depending on what type SAM it is. We wanted to get about 17 miles away from the field so they wouldn't shoot anymore at us. On the way out, I was going nose low, and I picked up two silver glints low on the trees. And at first, I thought they were some of our own airplanes, the attack airplanes that were bombing the missile sites exiting the target area. Well, I looked again, and there was two little glows behind each tailpipe. And if anybody knows, an A-7 does not have an afterburner. And none of the attack-type airplanes have afterburners, and they were too small to be Phantoms. And they weren't smoking like our Phantoms smoke. So I pressed after them. They were about 3 miles away, right down in the weeds. By the weeds, I mean about 200 feet above the ground. And they were in a canyon, so the canyon walls were above them. They were flying like down in a riverbed. Well, I pressed out and saw two of the prettiest little Delta Wing MiG-21s that you ever saw. And some plane captain's going to be highly perturbed because they were looked like they were spit shine. One MiG-21 was about 500 feet. Above the ground. The other MiG-21 was about 200 feet to 300 feet straight to the side of the other one and stepped up about 400 feet above his wingman. Pressed in behind the MiG on the port side, the left side, and locked him up on radar. And we have two types of weapons. We have a Sidewinder missile, which goes after a heat source, and we have a Sparrow missile, which is a radar missile. We need a radar lock by the radar system. I called Willie and told him we had two MiG-21s ahead of us. I told Brian Grant, my wingman, and tried to call in some other fighters, as well as notify the ships that were out in the Gulf, because we have fighters out along the water that can be vectored in to cut them off if they're heading for Bai Thong, which we tried to do also. Willie, I told him to go bore sight, which meant that I had the gun sight on the MiG. He throws a switch in the back, and the radar locks up on him. Well, he said, we've got a sweet lock, we're in range, shoot, shoot, shoot. Well, at that time, I reached over and hit the heat switch, which selects a Sidewinder missile. I fired several missiles at targets back in training in the States, and the Sparrow didn't knock down those targets. And when I shot Sidewinder at them, those targets went down. They were hit.
So in this particular action, you elected to shoot a heat seeker rather than the radar.
Yes.
And that was a Sidewinder.
Yes, all five of my kills were with a Sidewinder missile, and there's reasons for that also. We were fighting in a different environment than, say, the Air Force west of Hanoi. Their MiGs were a lot higher, and it was very hard to get a radar contact with MiGs going down in the weeds 50 to 100 feet. The radar can't see them there. In this case, we did have a radar lock. But I shot the first missile from dead 6 o'clock at about a little over a mile, and the MiG-21 broke hard starboard into me. He turned right, and I really expected for the other wingman to cross-turn and come back at me in a good tactical situation. Well, it didn't happen. I rolled over the top, and I was below him at this time. He was at 500 feet, and I was below the trees. doing approximately 600 knots, which is close to about 700 miles an hour. And things go by pretty quick. It's like riding a go-kart at 100 miles an hour, that sensation. Well, I rolled my wing over, and flying low hadn't bothered me that much until I saw the tree, the ground right off my wingtip and the trees there. So I pulled up sharply and rolled completely over the top. And I peered back at his wingman, thinking that he was going to cross-turn with the MiG, but he didn't. He just flat pushed over, unloaded his airplane, and left his wingman. Just left him. Didn't try to help him at all. His wingman, by braking like that, into the first missile. The first missile tracked him, tried to come around the corner, and went off under his tailpipe. As soon as the missile went off, the MiG reversed right in front of me, which gave me his tailpipe. I squeezed the second missile. As I completed the roll, 360-degree roll over the top, brought my nose, had a good tone, which you get when you have a sidewinder lock, squeezed the trigger, the missile hit him. We were about three-quarters of a mile to a half a mile, dead 6 o'clock, and the missile ripped off his entire tail. He pitched over and landed right next to a village. We passed over the fireball, and at that time the RA-5 photo bird was passing over and was going to try and take a picture of it, and my wingman was calling in that he had us in sight, and they launched a SAM at the RA-5, and he had to break off or we'd have had pictures of him splashing all over the ground. At that time, I looked up, and Willie said, "Duke, we got the other one at 2 o'clock. And a MiG-21 at a mile and a half, dead 6 o'clock, is very hard to see. He's like a pinhead. He's a small airplane. He's probably about a half to a third the size of an F-4. Well, he kept turning. They have a tactic where they turn back and forth, and he gives you a plan view of his airplane, and I could get him back in sight. Well, he climbed up to about 2,000 or 3,000 feet, and he was just going for Bai Thong. He was running. Got a radar lock on him, tried to shoot the Sparrow, and the Sparrow didn't come off the rail. And another reason for not shooting Sparrow, it wasn't that reliable missile for us. So we started taking tracers from a small village, and about that time Willie asked me, he says, "What's your fuel state?" And my exact words were, "Willie, don't bother me, I'm chasing a MiG." And I think I would have chased him clear to China. It's like having buck fever. I just tasted one kill, and I had visions of bagging two MiGs in one day. And no one had even seen a MiG for 2 years. This was the first MiG down in over 2 years. Lieutenant Bollier had downed one 2 years earlier than that. And it was like a dream that every fighter pilot works for, to prove yourself that you have the skills to bring down a MiG, and no one was even getting to see one. Well, we chased the other one, tried to shoot the missile, it didn't come off. And we were taking tracers, our fuel was running low, so we broke off the attack and went back and came back and landed. A lot of things that historians overlook, it's like people look at Joe Namath and the quarterbacks in a football game, but the real people that are responsible for that kill, Willie and I have 5 MiGs, but we only enjoy, I think, about 1/5,000th of the credit for that MiGs. We've got 5,000 other guys on the ship that we've got... ordnancemen that slap the missiles on there that ensure that they work. We've got the plane captains, we got the fuelers, the people that launch us off the cat. We got the maintenance people that keep the airplanes running and they work efficiently. There was a guy that used to at midnight named Ramirez that used to fix us double egg, double cheese, double fry burgers. All of these people play an important part, right down to the radar intercept officer or the controllers out on the picket ships. And A quick story on when we got back, they stopped all operations and we landed aboard the carrier, and Admiral Cooper, who was commander of Task Force 77, was on board, and Captain James D. Ward, the skipper of the USS Constellation, was there, and all the 5,000 guys on that ship, some of the guys that you hadn't seen for 3 months, the snipes that had come up from the grease pits, you know, 20 layers down in the ship, were all up on deck. And the plane captain, the ordnanceman that worked on my airplane, was Willie White, a colored boy that was a good friend, and we had a good relationship. But this little Willie White came up. He almost knocked over Admiral Cooper, went busting right through Captain James D. Ward, jumped up on the airplane, and here this Willie White had been loading Sidewinder and Sparrow missiles and bombs for this period, and no one had even seen him there. He jumped up on the airplane, grabbed me by the arm, and said, "Mr. Cunningham, I got my MiG today, didn't I?" And this is how the gents feel, and I think rightfully so. that the enlisted trooper, which is overlooked a lot, you're talking about 16, 17-year-old kids. And a lot of people criticize the morale on a carrier and so on, or ask what it is. This is a morale that existed. I know a lot of those troopers boosted my morale instead of vice versa.
Correct. Maybe one thing, Lieutenant Cunningham, you said 16 and 17. I don't believe they take them into the Navy at 16.
No, I think probably the youngest was 17, 18 years old. But they're very young type men. Well, we went after this. Shortly thereafter, the USS Constellation was scheduled to come back to the United States. I flew back while the ship was going to Japan. This was my second cruise, and I had what they call a magic carpet. You get to come back early instead of riding the ship back. Well, I got all the way back to the United States and decided, my parents were still living back in Missouri, and I decided to drive out to Missouri and visit with them.